Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. My name is Matt Hudson, and joining me, as ever, from across the pond, he's a statesman to my kingsman, and a bloody good fellow too, is John Burke from Burke Reviews. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well, Matt. How are you this Tuesday afternoon? Or
Tuesday
evening
afternoon,
for you,
so that's evening. Yeah, I'm doing very well. It is hot. It's hot over here. It's like I'm sitting here like clammy. Maybe that's also because of the offerings we've been checking out this week, of which we will get to in a minute. But yeah, I'm doing okay, my friend. Looking forward to diving into this particular episode, as I am with all of them, of course. But before that, you know what I'm going to ask. Are you keeping Florida safe and well?
I'm trying to protect Florida, but, you know, Florida does a lot to resist help and function. But, you know, it's been a rainy last 24 hours, although it's starting to warm up again today. But yeah, it's, you know, it's summer and it's hot and we're just hanging out.
That's what we like. Florida needs Burkman, the hero we all need right now, though I'm going to leave any Batman talk out because of recent stories. So I said I'm looking forward to tonight's episode, of which I always am. But last week we gave a preview of the 2021 Tribeca Film Festival, of which we mentioned then we have been granted accreditation to view all of the presentations on offer, of which we are eternally grateful. And we gave a few of our picks, early picks, last week of the movies we were looking forward to checking out. Some of them now have changed because of circumstances with Tribeca's distribution or the distribution of the agents who work with Tribeca. But for this episode, we are going to be diving into the festival and delivering mini reviews, non-spoiler reviews, of the films that we've been watching for this first nearly week of Tribeca. The films are coming thick and fast, and John and myself are, between us, doing our best to keep up with them, watch them, write about them, gather our thoughts, and come on to let you all know what we thought. So we've got about 10 films. Don't worry, we're not going to be going into them for an hour each. We're going to keep it fairly mini, and once again, spoiler-free thoughts, because as John mentioned last week, some of these films may or may not get distribution quickly, and we don't want to spoil it for anyone in advance. So,
but
with that said, John, shall we?
Well, before we get into the reviews, the other thing is that right now, if you're listening to this when it came out, most of these movies are still watchable on TribecaFilm.com. So if you are interested in any one of these and you want to see them, I don't know how much of the ticket price goes to the filmmakers themselves, but this is an opportunity for a lot of young and upcoming filmmakers. Some of these are first filmmakers. Some of these are just this is their second or third film. But if one of the films we talk about sounds like something you'd be interested in, I would encourage you to seek this out. This is an opportunity that a lot of times you wouldn't have to see these films unless you would fly out to a festival. But being able to sit at your home computer, pay the money, and again, potentially show distributors that there is an interest for these type of smaller, a lot of these are very personal films. And with some amazing casts, like these aren't just like small independent films with first time actors.
Yeah.
Some of them are. But if you are interested, you can watch them in the small window during the festival. And then, like Matt said, we don't know when they'll be available again. Some of these will have distribution right away, but we still may not see them for several months. And some of these will fade into, kind of purgatory where they exist somewhere. But where is will be a question. So.
Yep, well said, JB, and the prices kind of fluctuate depending on film as well. Go check it out, TribecaFilm.com. All the info's on there and when you can watch it and where and how you can watch it. So if what we say floats your boat, by all means, check it out and let us know what you think about these films as well. But obviously, if you are going to tell the world, try to keep it spoiler-free just for the courtesy of others. So the first film we're going to dive into was a film that John picked out last week and one of the first films to become available from the festival. And it's called 7 Days, directed by Roshan Sethi. It stars Karen Sonny, Geraldine Viswanathan, Zenobia Shroff, Aparna Nancherla, Geeta Reddy, Jeffrey Self, Mark Duplass, and John's grateful he didn't have to repeat all those names again. And it's a rom-com that eschews a few of the tropes, but for me, it felt like a bit like a missed opportunity at parts. I did like this film. I thought it was pretty cool. I thought it was quite funny. I think there's another film I'm going to mention as well but which has the same strength. But I think the two leads here, Viswana Fan and Dopinda, are sell this film. They make this film. If it wasn't for their kind of strange, awkward, crackling chemistry, then, you know, it maybe wouldn't have worked so much. But I thought this was a decent film. It felt, for the most part, fairly fresh. I've said on this show many times, to John's chagrin, jokingly, that sometimes the rom-com genre, as do many others, to be fair, but sometimes rom-coms can feel a bit formulaic and you kind of see what's coming from a mile off. And for some parts of this film, I thought, oh, we're gonna change things up a little bit, but not entirely. Some parts become a bit contrived and don't quite work. But that said, I liked the comedy. There are some bits where I found extremely funny. I liked the two main characters. I liked the situation they find them in. Of course, it's a COVID kind of based film. It's a film about being together against, kind of almost against your wills, in a quarantine. And I thought this was pretty good. I'd like to see this pick up more of a cult following, because I do think it deserves that. I think it's a good film. It's a very good feature debut from Roshan Sethi as well. And it's again, like we did with White Tiger, it shines the light on Indian filmmakers and Indian actors and actresses as well. So it's giving a spotlight to those who, up until recently, haven't really had that international kind of spotlight. So I think this is a pretty good film. I didn't mind it. John, what did you think?
When it started, I'm a big fan of rom-coms, which we say every time we talk about a rom-com.
And horses.
I was a little disappointed because it was feeling a little... It wasn't making me laugh as much, and I was a little annoyed with Karen Soni more than I was expecting to be. I really liked him in Deadpool and found his comedy charming. But it feels like a performance, and I think that happens here at first, but it starts to feel a little more natural as the film moves on. But by the end of the film, I loved it. I'm a big fan of both actors. Geraldine kind of broke out with Blockers a few years ago and was also really good in Bad Education from last year. And I want to see them in more stuff. I just think they're so charming. There's a lot of funny parts, but there's a lot of heart in this movie. And I really found the love element to be endearing. And I, if I remember correctly, I choked up a couple of times, which I am wont to do. I don't know if you saw that Sony is a co-writer with the director.
Yes, I've just, who I also called Dopinda. That was I got his Deadpool character in my head for because that's where he kind of broke out. So yeah, Sony. Yes. He did co-wrote this. Yes.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's also really cool to see that not only, you know, did he star in, but also co-wrote. And I know there's a lot about the culture. I think the commentary on like the arranged marriage is interesting in this movie, because a lot of times it feels very judgmental. Like the assumption is that it's just wrong versus it's not wrong. It's just one way of how people can end up together. And I think the film does a good job of more of exploring it rather than condemning it as like this archaic institution. And I think there's some, the movie opens with like some interviews of, I'm assuming, actual arranged couples. I don't know if they're just actors pretending to be actual arranged couples. But I assume that those were genuine, and I like that. Because again, I think a lot of times when the norm of our country, I think our countries, is not arranged marriages, we often assume that arranged marriages are weird or different. They are obviously different than what we're used to, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong. But I do think a lot of times we come at it as this place of judgment. And I think this movie, it has both sides, but I think it's an interesting conversation that the movie's having with it rather than it just being there. And The Big Sick discusses it as well, which is one of my favorite rom-coms in the last few years. And I have I heart Kumail Nanjiani so much. And his, you know, that film being based on his actual story, I also found very, very compelling. But I think this movie deals more with, because Kumail is not pro arranged marriage, right? Like that's in that movie. So there still has that American kind of condemnation of it. Where this movie, I think, plays with a little more. I think it's a little more flexible with things. And I liked it. We don't want to spend too much time on this, so I think there's nothing else to say without spoiling things. But I think this was my first COVID film that I can remember watching. There might have been one more that I have like blocked out, but I think it did a good job of using it and not solely dwelling on it, but using it as like the catalyst for the story that it wanted to tell. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It didn't feel like it didn't feel manipulative or anything like that.
Right. It's not the story. It's just an element of the story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It just happens to be set in that time. Where, yeah, they're not glorifying or anything like that. It, like you say, it's just a fabric of the story. So so it seems like we're both pretty up on it. I think you were slightly more so than I am. Yeah. But again, I enjoyed it, and I would like to see this picked up and get a little following going, because I think it's a solid film. So that was 7 days, and you're up next, JB.
All right, well, this one's ironic, because I only watched this one because you had brought it up. And I'm mad at you for that. I'm mad at you for it because I didn't like it. It's called All My Friends Hate Me. And you know what? I hate him too. That's the reality. The main character, it's a quote unquote horror comedy thriller. I'm a big fan of horror comedy. I don't think this one was very funny. There are some funny parts. There's some good performances, but I think overall the writing is what didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. Without getting into specifics, because I don't want to spoil the movie, the thing that it's trying to do is spelled out way too hard, I think. And right. It's not, I don't think it's supposed to be, and it is. It's like, it's a little too on the nose, so that when you get to the point where it's supposed to be like, haha, it's like, yeah.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
It was kind of torturous at times because I didn't like the main character, and ironic. And I think, I feel like the movie wants us to be on his side, and I never was. And so that makes it really complicated to care about what's happening, because you're just like, yeah, but you're kind of a jerk. I don't care that you're upset. That was my take. It's not necessarily bad. It's just, I was ready for it to be over. It's only 93 minutes. So it wasn't like it was super long. It was just like, okay, I get it. I get it. I get it. I get it. Is it over? No, I still have to sit here for another 20 minutes and wait for them to find. Yeah. So again, not the worst. It just didn't click for me. And I was a little disappointed. And I've been on a bit of a horror kick. So I was kind of excited that you had mentioned this one. I was like, all right, cool. Matt seems interested in it. But yeah, it just didn't work for me. So my friends hate me. Yeah. Sorry.
And I think John hates me a little bit now.
No, never. It's not possible. But
just a bit.
It is directed by Andrew Gaynord, who is apparently known for Netflix's comedy series, The Characters, that I've also never heard of. But you know, it's cool. It's his feature debut. I don't think it's badly directed or anything. I just think the writing didn't quite do it for me, and that is not him. So, Andrew, maybe you just need a better script.
The lead co-wrote this, Tom Stourton. He co-wrote this with a guy called Tom Palmer.
Well, I didn't... You know, if his goal was for us to hate him too, he succeeded in my regard. I was not vibing with the character, so...
Well, maybe if I've got a spare 90 minutes at the end of the festival, I'll check this one out. See, this is, you know, why I feel it's so, you know, good to have reviews of films coming out early, because you get some buzz or you get some general consensus, because the film sounded fairly decent to me on paper, as obviously it must have done to you when I pulled it out, because you went to watch it. But it's not everything's going to work. But now it's kind of put me off watching it, whereas I think I'll prioritize other things ahead of it.
I do want to point, it's not bad. Like I didn't write a review, but I wouldn't say it's like avoid like the plague or anything like that. It's nothing. I'm probably making it sound way harsher than it should, because I didn't enjoy watching it. Yeah. But it's not, there's nothing like glaring, like, other than, again, I feel like the two main things is the main character wasn't likable, so I didn't care what he was complaining about. And then the thing that I mentioned with the reveal feeling very like a little too foreshadowed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And again, maybe I just picked up on something that other people may not, and so it might land differently for those, for a different viewer. But
All My Friends Hate Me Then. Not a particularly glowing review from JB. That's available to watch up until the 23rd of June on TribecaFilm.com. So if you still fancy it, check it out. The next film we're jumping on to is it's another one I picked out from last week, and it's called Agnes. And it was kind of billed as a horror film. You know, it's a typical exorcism movie was how I assumed it was going to be. So I was like, yeah, you know what? That sounds like a bit of me for obvious reasons. Also, as you know, I'm a horror fan, so I'm always going to be turned on by the idea of a decent horror film. So I went into Agnes thinking I was going to get one thing, and it was not what you expect it to be at the film Agnes. You assume, based on the synopsis, the images that accompany the film, that it's going to be an exorcism film with a very religious backdrop set in a convent with a lot of nuns. The first part of the film is very much that. And then it has a surprising shift of tone, shift of genre and story direction at a certain point. And it goes off to somewhere I didn't think it was going to go necessarily. It becomes more of a reflection on loss, you know, mother's loss and grief than anything that I thought the film was going to be, especially given the title of the film and the character that it refers to. The direction of the film, like the direction by Mickey Rees, I believe the director is, it's very stark and it kind of matches the stark imagery of the film as well. It feels very cold. It feels like I wanted it to, certainly in those early scenes, the first half of the film, when we are kind of more dealing with the nuns and the religious aspect of it, that's how I wanted it to feel. It kind of had that isolated yet slightly strange atmosphere, not scary but kind of tense atmosphere for a little bit, and then you get your very standard exorcism moments, which were very ho-hum if you ask me. I thought I've seen this many times before. It didn't really work for me, that side of it. But as a film, I thought it was, I wasn't overly sold by it. A lot of the films I've seen so far have been about 90 minutes to 100 minutes, which is pretty good, actually, to be able to scram something. But I wasn't overly sold by Agnes, not because it changed direction, it wasn't what I wanted it to be, but when it did change direction, I wasn't really in. You know, I wasn't particularly invested in the characters that we were following. The reasoning of why we followed them, you know, very, very sad. I was in on that, but that wasn't always at the forefront. And we had a lot of sequences which kind of just felt, I mentioned ho-hum again, they were just sort of, you know, they were there to set up this very different, very vanilla world that she now finds herself in. And there was a few narrative decisions I thought were a bit strange. Some of the dialogue in the second half of the film I thought was a bit strange. Didn't feel real. It felt a bit forced. And I just kind of felt a bit unsatisfied by the end of it. I didn't really feel like I'd gotten anything at the end of it, or I felt like maybe the director wanted me to feel. I wouldn't necessarily have said I would have preferred a straight-up exorcism film, because not all of them are very good. And again, it's been done before. So I applaud Mickey Rees for taking it in a different direction, but in this instance, it just didn't work for me. I felt some of the gravitas at points, but not fully. It was, so this one was, again, by all means, check it out, because you know you're helping somebody out who's made a film that looks very good. Acting's fine for the most part, but this one isn't my favourite of what I've seen. I can't imagine it challenging my top 10 list by the end of the festival. But you saw Agnes as well, JB. Were you a fan?
I think I'm a little more up on it than you. I would have. He plays with a few ideas that I wish he would have leaned more into, especially in the idea of, like, I feel like he wants to walk a line of whether or not the exorcism is real or not, or if the possession, I guess, is real or not. And I think he leans one direction more than he should have. I think it should have been a little more ambiguous, and I think it would have made for a more interesting film, especially when it takes the shift in the genre. I think had it been less clear which side, and I'm not saying which way he went, I'm saying if it had been less clear which way he went, I think it would be much more interesting because it would leave you to ponder a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Did what we see actually happen, or was that someone's interpretation of something? I think he makes it very clear where he falls down on in this movie, or at least it felt a little too clear. We just recently reviewed Conjuring 3, and the exorcism scenes are way over the top and very, very Hollywood. I liked the exorcism scenes in this movie because they felt like you were in the room with them and it was actually happening, as opposed to being like gigantic and massive effects and stuff like that.
I like the execution, just not the dialogue that accompanied them.
Yeah, a lot of the dialogue did feel a little tacked on. Most of the cast was pretty new. However, there were some cool people in this. Sean Gunn, who I'm always a fan of. Jake Horowitz was in Vast of Night that we watched, I think, last year for the podcast, which I really liked. I think I liked that more than you, if I remember correctly.
You were more so up on that than I was, yeah.
Yeah, we both were positive, but I think I was a little more like, I really enjoyed it. But he was the lead, and I really liked him in that, and he's kind of the lead here. The lead isn't clear for a good chunk of the movie, right? Like, you're not really sure who we're following for a good part, and then it becomes, this is their movie. Okay. I liked a lot of it. It is weird, and it does some things. It feels very indie, and that's the kind of this director's like whole thing from what I'm like looking at in the Tribeca kind of overview. They call him Soderbergh of the Sticks, which I'm like, I've only seen this movie, I think, by this guy, so I don't know if this movie is enough to qualify that. I've become a pretty big Soderbergh fan at this point. I didn't see that in this movie, but cool if that's what somebody calls him that. I like the ambition here. I wish the execution was a little tighter, but.
Yeah, I think, I think you're slightly more up on this, and I take your points and I accept them, JB. It's a very well-made film, but for me, it fell flat, but for JB, it soared a little bit higher than for me. So that was Agnes. What's up next, JB?
So I watched God's Waiting Room, I watched this one because it was set in Florida, Tyler Riggs, I guess, is from Florida, moved to New York, so like this is his kind of return home movie. He is the director. This is the holy trinity of Tyler Riggs. It's a director, screenwriter, editor, actor. I guess more than trinity. The Room. Fortunately, it's not nearly as ridiculous as The Room. And yet there is this kind of heightened melodrama in it that I didn't like bite on. I feel like there's pieces of like, it wants to be American Honey, but it's nowhere near to that level. It's trying some of the character, like Jules, who's played by Matthew Leone, feels a little big at times, where it's like he's more of a caricature than he is a character. Rosie's the lead. I don't really feel like we get enough from Rosie. Like, we get little glimpses of who she is, and then there is this narrative that Tyler Riggs' character, he's kind of disconnected from the main story until eventually fate kind of intervenes. And it's definitely not bad. My initial reaction was I didn't like it. And then as it sat with me and I've thought about it, I've come to be a little more positive on it. Because I think there's good here, and I definitely don't want to, you know, shut down a young filmmaker. I think it would be a good idea for him to work with more people. But maybe let's say he couldn't get a movie made, so he just did everything himself. Then this is a pretty solid outcome. I would like to maybe him get with someone else to write, to help with some of the dialogue. Some of the dialogue felt real, real generic. And the performances weren't bad. I think most of the, like, Matthew Leon is from something else. I think Nazalda Gonzalez, this is one of her first things. And she's got talent. Some of the extras were pretty solid. A lot of the conflict felt contrived, though, and very forced. And there was no real explanation for people to be so, like, on edge and angry all the time. It's just, you know, they're there for the sake of it. And then Tyler Riggs' character, especially, there's a lot of things where the subtext is maybe not clear enough. Like, I appreciate him not having big exposition dumps, but at the same time, it's just like, yeah, but you need a little, like, clarity. It needs to be clear why we get a scene of him in the bathroom watching porn. Like, we need to know why. I wasn't clear there to me. It became clear later, but it's still, I'm like, man, I don't understand what we're supposed to take from that. I don't understand why that's the thing. I think maybe it's there, and maybe it's something I'm not familiar with, but there's little things I think could really make this movie a little more palatable, a little better. But overall, not horrible. Again, represent Florida. It definitely has that. It feels hot, like you're in Florida. Like, it feels like you're there. So again, was a movie that while watching it, I was kind of like, you know, rolling my eyes at times and was ready for it to be over. And at its conclusion, though, I was, you know, I've thought back on it, and I don't think it was as bad as I initially was vibing. And sometimes that is, I was ready to do other things. I'd watched several movies at that point throughout the last couple of days. And I was definitely like, okay, I want to do anything else for a little while. And that the movie definitely took a little hit from that too. So that's not the movie's fault. That's what happens when you watch a bunch of movies at a festival.
Yeah, it can be a lot. It's fun to watch them, but after when you get to your fourth one of the day and you've spent, best part, 8 hours of staring at something, your brain gets frazzled. So that's fair enough, JB.
And I think being at home doing a festival too is that you're in the same exact spot for most of it. Yeah. Or like if you're at, like when I was at South By a couple years ago, or even depending on the year of Tribeca, it's usually not all in the same, even at the very least, it's not in the same auditorium. So you're still getting out of the auditorium, maybe going across the street for a slice of pizza, coming back, or you have to go to a different theater, like all together. So you have to like run from this theater, like down the road, or get an Uber or taxi, whatever. And so you're mobile, you're doing stuff.
Yeah.
When you're just clicking play and then watching another one in the same seat, it does start to become tedious. And so the last couple of days I've tried to break up my movie watches so they're not so consecutive, but.
Yep. Tips for film watching by JB. I dig it. There's a God's Waiting Room. Again, you know, it's fine. The next one on the list is one that John pulled out last week, and based on it, John recommending it and the synopsis, I was quite looking forward to watching this one. It's called Mark, Mary, and Some Other People. It's a rom-com. You know, John loves a rom-com. John loves horses. And it's a polyamorous romantic comedy, I think is the best way to put it. For those who are polyamorous, is when you have more than one sexual partner, but everybody's fine with it. Everyone involved in the web is okay with it. So this is what this film kind of deals with. And it's got two fabulous, fabulous lead performances from Hayley Law and Ben Rosenfield. The casting of those two together was superb. And I said up top with the 7 days review that there was another film where I think the casting, I don't want to say saved it, because I had a really good time with this film, but I think it only accentuated the film, the pairing of Law and Rosenfield. I thought they were so good together. I thought Brandon Rosenfield was a very good lead, and Hayley Law was really cool, really fresh, someone I wasn't particularly well up on. So it's, as I say, it's a rom-com. It starts off really well with a cool premise, with one which, again, twisting the standard conventions, which I thought the opening act was great, the opening sequence. There's some good jokes throughout. Is it entirely original, or is it going to leave you shocked and surprised? No, but along the way, there's enough cool stuff and enough fun little moments to keep you, or get me invested, and I think it'll keep most other people as well. Plus, just the fact that they're dealing with like the polygamy, the polyamorous side of it, that's not something you see in a rom-com. So in it already, it's open, it's different, literally, and different. And there's some moments in it which I found quite nice, you know what I mean, quite sweet, quite heartwarming, I think the word is. A few moments between the two lead characters when they're doing things together and helping each other out, and I thought that was quite nice. Lots of the good stuff, if that's what you're asking. You get some steamy moments, you get some good fun laugh out loud moments, you get some very good supporting performances as well. I think the actual cast as a whole is really solid here. It's Hannah Marks is a director, and I think she does a really, really good job with this film. So I think it was a lot of fun, and I would tell people to go out and check this film out.
I saw Hannah Mark's last film she directed was Banana Split, which I saw, I think, in 2019 or early 20. I think it might have been right at the start of COVID last year that I got a screener for it, and I loved it. I thought it was great. She's also in Dinner in America that we saw at Fantasia Fest. She's only in it for a little bit. She's in like the opening scene, the dinner sequence that starts the movie off. But she's terrific in that scene. She didn't direct that one, but she's in that movie. And I think that might be where she meets, oh my gosh, the Back to the Future lady whose name isn't coming to me.
But
it's right there. It starts with L.
Leah Thompson.
Leah Thompson. That's it. You got it.
I got the L right. She
has a small cameo.
Yeah.
Small cameo in this movie. But Hannah, I just think, is an up and coming like superstar in the comedy genre. She has a really interesting voice. I love the way she handles sexuality in both Banana Split and this, because it's super tasteful. And yet she doesn't censor it or take it away, but she also doesn't show a lot of nudity. I don't think there was any nudity in this movie
They're well handled.
Sexuality is there. You get what's happening without it having to be graphic. And I think like the dialogue's graphic, but the visuals aren't. And I think that's important, because you're not asking your actors to do something uncomfortable or compromising. But you're not also sacrificing your content in a way that just really works. I was already a fan of Hayley Law. I kind of raved about her on the preview episode. She's been the best friend character in two movies that I thought were fantastic, The New Romantic and Spontaneous from last year. This is the first time I've got to see her in the lead, and she crushes it. I thought she was tremendous in this movie. Rosenfeld, I was instantly his hair and mustache. I was just like, you should be Anton Yelchin. If Anton Yelchin wasn't dead, this role would be Anton Yelchin.
A good show.
That for several early scenes, I'm like, man, how would Anton have done this? And yet, by the end of the movie, I was so into this guy that he overcame that. And I think that speaks volumes, that he was able to get out of my head. Like, even though in my head I was like recasting him, he won me over. And I just think that speaks to how great his performance is. I laughed a lot. I also was very emotionally attached to these characters. You mentioned several like scenes that I won't spoil the scenes, but there's a scene with Oreos that cracked me up so much. And it's also so sweet and so endearing. Just their chemistry. There's this natural chemistry between the two of them that just feels so organic and real. Just an excellent example of a romantic comedy. And again, it does deal in a, the setup is very unique, although there is another polygamy movie called The Unicorn that I saw at, I think, Tribeca 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, 2 or 3 years ago. That was also very good. It might have been South by, I don't remember. 2018 was a really busy movie year for me. I saw a lot of movies that year. So, but the Unicorn is another polygamy comedy. I think this one's better. Because it's not trying to, like, the unicorn's like one night a couple decides they want to try to have a threesome, so they're looking for the unicorn, the mythical person that they can have the threesome with. Well, this is like a long-term relationship and how this kind of open marriage works. It's just really, it's interesting. I enjoyed it very, very much.
Hannah Marks describes it as ethical non-monogamy, which is a cool little soundbite there. It's well written as well, I have to say that. I think the film is, the subjects matter as well. Like you said, it's handled really well, like intelligently as well. And, you know, it's not in your face. You know, there's actually, you know, Hannah Marks, and does she screenwrites? She does write this film, yes. She handles the subject really well. She puts it across well. It doesn't ever feel like preachy or doesn't feel in your face. It felt like, hey, I can watch this and I can learn a few things from this, which I appreciate. So I really like this film. I'm glad to hear that you did too as well, man. So
I'm going
to
point out that my hot take about her being like an up and coming, both Rolling Stones and Forbes magazine have named her like in the top like 25 under 25 and 30 under 30. So
that's only since you just mentioned that. It's fine.
I didn't know that since you just mentioned it, though, that. To be fair, saying.
They heard so, John Burke thinks that. Quick, get it in first, they're thinking.
Yep.
That's all it is, my friend.
30 under 30, I think, Hannah Marks on the list. There you
that's
go.
Yeah, that's it. You heard it here first. Book review, 30 under 30. So Mark, Mary and some other people. Great title. We're both very up on that film. It seems like the film so far we're both most up on. Yeah. Over to you next, JB.
So Italian Studies is the new film from director Adam Leon, who I've only seen his film Tramps, which was a Netflix original a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. That we covered on the Movie Club podcast, and it stars Vanessa Kirby, who she's just kind of blowing up the spot in the last couple of years. You know, she had a really good Oscar run. I have still not seen her Oscar performance. I need to watch that.
No, Pieces of a Woman, sorry.
Yes, I have not watched it yet, so I don't have an opinion on that, but I have liked her in the movies I've seen her in. Even Hobbs and Shaw, I kind of think she was the highlight of Hobbs and Shaw. This movie is really interesting. It was a little hard for me to get fully into because I do inherently lean towards plot and story for the things that grab me about a movie. And this movie is definitely like plot's not important here. There's more experiential and contemplative, which once I kind of was able to get that and let go of the plot elements, I definitely was really kind of moved into this movie. I keep thinking about it. It's very, very compelling in that way. Kirby's performance, again, outstanding. But what I don't, and not to take away from her performance, but there is a newcomer named Simon Brickner, who kind of plays like the second lead. He's definitely the co-star. There's a bunch of characters who have small little bit parts, but he is the only other character who has any kind of purpose or function in the story, for what story there is. And instantly, I was like intrigued by this kid. I think Ehrlich, David Ehrlich, writer for IndieWire, I think refers to him as like a cross between Lucas Hedges and somebody else. I don't remember who the other person was, but he's on point with that assumption. He's got that kind of same natural charm that you're just like, I don't know what it is about you, but I really like you and keep talking. And there's moments where like she's kind of, like the story is very loose with the why, but for some reason she's kind of forgotten who she is. And she's wandering Manhattan, kind of clueless. No purse, nothing. She has nothing. And she seems very vulnerable, and yet she's competent. She's not like so like crazy where she will do anything, but you're also like you're not sure if she's making good decisions in every scenario. And when she first meets him, there is this like instinct of like, this guy's going to try something. Right. And immediately he's so charming that you're just like, yeah, it's probably okay. You can trust him. Like you're just, your guard is let down. And that's I'm not trying to set up that it's, you shouldn't or whatever. No, no. I'm just saying his charm is so unique. So really this is his debut. And so really great find from Leon. I don't know how he found him or whatever, but the kid has got something. I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing him in A24 movies, pushing Lucas Hedges out, or at least fighting for the same roles as Hedges, but really, really like him too. So the chemistry between those two characters, really the emotional kind of crux of the film. It's not perfect, and there are some, it's definitely not going to work for everybody because it isn't a traditional film in a lot of ways. There's going to be a lot of questions that are left unanswered, and some people hate that. But it's not about the questions. Like that's not what the movie's trying to do. And I think what it's trying to do, I think it's really interesting and thought provoking and it's worth watching. It is very short. It's just 79 minutes. So it's definitely worthy of one's time. Although maybe it's not something like it's definitely not something for everybody. So it's hard to just outright give it a recommendation, but I have found it to be really compelling. And the more I've sat with it and thought about it, I just keep thinking about it. So that in that way, I think if a movie's quality is measured by its impact on the viewer, it's definitely had a lasting impact. So it must be pretty good.
Yep. And if it, I know, JB likes to sit on his films, if you will, but I know when a film sits with John, that it's resonated to a level more so than most. So I'm interested to see how that manifests in the next few days. And I mean that I'm going to catch up with you and I'll say, right, now you've had an extra few days. Is it still with you? Has it grown? Have you absorbed it or have you pushed it away? So I'm always interested in that. It's one I'm going to check out. I like Vanessa Kirby as an actress. I think she's for the most part, very good in Pieces of a Woman. And the film itself sounds intriguing. And if there's a Lucas Hedges light in there, great. Maybe it'll actually give Lucas Hedges a day off for once. You can cast them both now and they can take some of the load off Lucas being in every single film out there. But no, I'll tell you, worth a watch, JB?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep, so we'll check that one out. So Italian Studies was John's. The next one for me is a film called See For Me, S-E-E, See For Me. It's another horror thriller film. And it's the second feature film from Randall Akita. And it is a home invasion film with a twist that the home being invaded is not owned by the person who's in it. The person who's in it is a blind skier, former skier called Sophie. She's played by Skylar Davenport. She's blind. She had an accident when she was on the slopes and she's lost her vision. And she's cat sitting in a mansion. You know, in the snowy hills. So we have a blind woman, cat sitting in a mansion, very big mansion. And then three thieves decide to come in and try stealing stuff. So we've got a home invasion where there are thieves in the house. There are people trying to steal something. And you've got the only person in the house other than the cat who gets short shrift, the cat, justice for the cat, is a blind female who's there by herself. But she's been given access to this app by her worrisome mother called See For Me, and basically you ring somebody on this app, you connect with someone and via video call, and they can describe that your setting for you. So for example, that they would say, you know, keep walking forward in 10 feet, there's six steps, you know, there, can you angle your phone so I can see what's around the corner. They were, you know, for want of a better term, they were your eyes in this film. So Sophie connects with a gamer called Kelly, who's played by Jessica Parker Kennedy, and there's more to Kelly than meets the eye. And basically it's a home invasion movie with a twist. I think this one started off quite well. I think it started off well once it gets going after the initial 20 minutes, it got quite interesting. But then for me, it fell away in the third act. It just gave in to cliche convention. And to be honest, it was a bit rubbish. I thought the third act, there's a named actor in this film who doesn't turn up through a lot of the film, so it's entirely given away what their part of the film is. It looked stunning, though. The film looked incredible. And not just like the visual style of it. The DOP was Jordan Oram and Jackson Parrell, but some of the shots that were utilised were superb. A really inventive use of camera angles, and ways of capturing shots. They managed to capture the sort of snowy isolation really well. Funny shot, clever shots, snowy isolation, mansion, you think Shining. The opening scene is fairly trippy, and it was a bit Shining-esque, you're following a car. The music was fine. Music's by an artist or artists called Menelon. I thought that was fine, but I would rather listen to it in isolation. It didn't quite work with the film. Sound design was pretty good, but it just, I don't know, there's something, the lead actress, I think this is her first film, I could not vibe with her performance. She was in the film, the character of Sophie is intentionally prickly. She's very, wants to be very independent, but it does just come across as, okay, you're just actually quite rude. And the character of Kelly does say that a few times, but she does just come across as unlikable for quite a lot of it. And that really did hinder my connection to her for a lot of the film. And there's quite a few things that happen as we go on, which are just kind of, like you said, you roll your eyes that you think, oh, come on, or revelation. How did you know how to do that? Well, as it turns out, actually, really? Just going to throw that in. It's that, and it got a bit silly towards the end. And they really missed an opportunity, I think, here, because there are some good moments of tension, but it just gives way to action towards the end, and it felt very contrived. It felt a bit silly, and it was a good premise, but I don't think the execution matched the potential of this film. Again, well worth a watch. If you like a thriller film, check it out, because there's going to be a lot you like. It depends on your tolerance for how far the film goes and how you find that final sequence. But See For Me, yeah, very good premise, a lot of good execution, but didn't meet the potential for me.
That's nice. It sounds really interesting. Kind of reminds me of like a similar thing to Hush.
He's similar to that. Obviously. Yeah, Hush was a better film, though. Yeah.
Mm. Well, I may skip that one. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. See, for me,
it sounds kind of interesting.
Well, I saw for you there. Is that a good? Does that work, Mo? Maybe. Well, I saw for John. Yeah. See, for me, it's okay. What have you got next, JP?
So I watched a film called Poser, mm-hmm. and this one, Big Tuna, had recommended, and I didn't really even look at it at first, it's totally kind of up our alley because it's about a podcaster, a common protagonist trope now that is happening.
Yeah.
So all of the music and all of the artists in the film are actual musicians and artists. I knew none of them.
Nice.
Because it's very underground music and genres. It's all over the place. I mean, that's the whole thing. This girl is her podcast is about like these underground artists, and that's what she's trying to do. And there's this kind of idea of like creating. I mean, the word poser. Like, I don't know. I was like heavy into like heavy metal and hard rock, mm-hmm. and we called a lot of people posers.
Yes.
You know, if we didn't feel like you earned your spot in our social group that was all built around our music interest, you were a poser. Like if you were not a pretender, you don't really belong here. And this, it takes that idea very extreme, like beyond just like pretending to like something to fit in. It's almost like as if you are a blank slate and you are taking other people's personalities to make them your own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. There's a lot of cool visual elements. The music is compelling. I think the performance, it's very subdued and she's got like a very monotone nature. Her name's Sylvie Mix, but I think it's good. I think it fits the character. There's just enough charm there that you kind of see that there is some spark of personality, but it's purposely kind of bland.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bobby Kitten is the other listed cast member, and she is the lead singer of this real band and is playing herself in this movie, which is kind of surreal. And that's mm-hmm. where it feels a little pretentious because it's this kind of unknown band playing themselves at a heightened level.
Yep.
But I don't know who you are. So like this could have been a fictional band and I would have believed that. again, not because it's bad. You don't hear a lot of their music enough that there's definitely talent there. It may not be for me, but I could definitely see people being into it or whatever. But like there's an ongoing joke with my movie club partner, Corey, that she makes up the bands that she listens to. Anytime I come across a band that I've never heard of before that apparently is famous, I immediately ask her if she's a fan. Which is what happened here. I was like, hey, do you know this band? And she's like, no. I'm like, oh, okay. It seemed like something you would have been into. just because apparently they're popular, but I didn't know they existed. But yeah, so I don't know if it is necessarily pretentious, but there does. It's just, you know, choosing to like write a script around your actual banks. Like, let's look at singles, right? From the early 90s. You have a bunch of iconic grunge bands in the movie. Most of them are not playing themselves. Like Chris Cornell is in Matt Dillon's band. You know, and I think it's most of Temple of the Dog, if I'm not mistaken.
Corvetta, Cornell. Yeah.
Alice in Chains plays at one of the clubs that they're in. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if they actually are listed as Alice in Chains or not, but it is Alice in Chains playing.
Got a hell of a soundtrack, is what it has got.
Right. But that movie is a little pretentious, right? Like that's kind mm-hmm. of the thing about singles is all these people are like all up in and of themselves. So it might be by design here. But I didn't feel like it was like, it didn't feel like that was in the thematic elements of the movie. It was almost like the opposite of it. It was just like this poor girl who's just trying to like find herself, is not sure who she is essentially. I don't know. It's interesting. There's some really cool visuals. I think it works as a movie. But it's definitely a little unique. So worth checking out if you're into like podcasting music based, movies. So,
it's fairly niche there, but if that's your jam.
Yeah.
And Corey, check it out because your knowledge of music is flagging by the sounds of it. If you haven't heard of insert band name here. I'm sure we could go on a random band name generator and probably still heard of them.
That was one of my favorite bits in Mark Mary and some other people was the band name bits. That cracked me up every time.
Good man. I'm glad you got that because I just realized it's fairly inside baseball, but not for JB. So Poser was John's film there. The final one I've seen for this week that I've seen anyway was called No Man of God. And I picked this last week as one that I was interested in seeing. And it's directed by Amber Seeley. And it stars Luke Kirby as Ted Bundy and Elijah Wood as the man whose name I can't remember, FBI agent Bill Hagmire. And it's basically Hagmire is a profiler. He wants to get inside the mind of Ted Bundy and find out who the man is behind the mystique and the myth and sadly the legend as well. And I had high hopes for this. I was worried that it would glamorize too much Ted Bundy, which is what a lot of recent films or exposés and serial killers have been accused of, you know, being too sympathetic to the killers or trying to glamorize it or make them more rock and roll than they are. But I didn't feel that with this one. I didn't get that at all. So I'm quite happy about that. What I did get was a fabulous performance from Luke Kirby as Ted Bundy. I think he's great. I thought that Zac Efron was really good. I think Luke Kirby is really very good. I only know Ted Bundy from what I've seen on documentaries and whatnot, but Luke Kirby feels like Ted Bundy here. I think that was key to the film. If you're going to do a film about him, that person, you have to believe that person. Elijah Wood, I think, was very good as well. I think Elijah Wood, again, he's maturing more and more, and I think he brings a good level of performance to here. And it felt like a stage show at points, which is what I liked about it. For a lot of the time, most of the time, it's those two opposite each other on a table and they're talking, or Hack Hagmire is profiling, and we're waiting for to see what Ted Bundy will drop, what information he's going to give us. Of course, those who know the story of him will know what to expect per se from the end or so, or any revelation, quote unquote, that we're going to get. So there's nothing new here, anything like that. And I guess that's the only criticism, is that there's nothing new here. It is very much, if you know Ted Bundy and you know the story of him and Hagmire's kind of tennis match type thing, chess match kind of conversations, then you know, you'll know that this is still just a profile of a very, very famous evil person. But I think it was well made. I think it was the ending, I thought, was really good. The final sort of sequences, I thought they were really good. And I thought it was written well. I thought it was handled well. And what could have been actually quite boring, I think, if in the wrong hands or not portrayed very well, I think was done pretty good. So pretty well. So I was, you know, pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed this, appreciated this film. I don't think it's the best term for it, but I thought this was really quite good. But I know you saw this as well, didn't you, mate?
Yeah, I liked it. I also do. If the dialogue is written well in talking movies, I very much love them. I'm a big fan of Tarantino, for example. His dialogue is always very flashy, and Kevin Smith, you know, a lot of his scenes are just two guys talking. I am fine with that if the conversation's compelling and keeps me hooked, and it feels like I'm a part of it. And I do think this movie does a pretty good job with that. I think both performances are really good. Elijah Wood's eyes are always going to be his downfall because he has anime eyes, and it's so hard to look at him outside of being like kind of a cartoon character.
Poor Elijah.
There were some dark moments that I don't know if it fully, like the implications about the character that he's playing, that Hagmire, like there's some stuff that I don't know that it felt right. Like it felt a little contrived to me at certain points with like the implications of like a darker side to him. And it is kind of walking this line of are people who are serial killers crazy, or have they just made a choice that other people actively choose not to? And it's a scary thought. You know, that people could just kill, but just choose not to. And I think that's intriguing as a line of reasoning, but it's also that line of reasoning is introduced by the person who is potentially crazy. So it, can you, is that a reliable narrator of that line of thought? You know what I mean? Like yeah. If he is crazy, can he rationalize what he's doing to not be crazy? You know, it's a very slippery slope of reality, but, I did like the movie. I don't know if it does glamorize him or not. Because he does come off as very cool and arrogant, mm-hmm. and arrogance obviously not usually associated with cool, right? But I mean, he doesn't come off as
the attitude he brings. I know what you mean, yeah.
Right? Yeah, it's just this. I am the smartest person in any room at any time, and that's mm-hmm. he doesn't directly say that, but he almost does, right? Like yeah. It's almost stated outright.
And, overconfident demeanor, yeah.
And if that's how Bundy was, I don't know that it's necessarily wrong to portray them that way, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to think to a degree that there was something that naturally charismatic about him that he was able to lure so many women into his clutches, you know? And even when he talks about some of those incidents, how he would like, there would be things that were clearly people should be questioning. Like he's a police officer in a Volkswagen. Like, and people would believe that he was a police officer. It's like, but why would I be in a Volkswagen? Like, he says that outright in one scene. So those things, you got to wonder, like, at what point is it glorification? At what point is it just, here's how he was, you decide. But what are we at? What are we being asked to decide? Like, yeah. That it was, you know, but it's obviously a compelling topic, right? True crime right now is just all the rage. It's everywhere. Yeah. And this is, it's one of the most horrific true crime stories that exist.
Yeah.
So I think every version that we get is going to bring viewers, and you know, hopefully it's not glorifying the man himself. Even when you're casting handsome guys to portray him, that it's not inherently a negative thing. I don't know. I'm not of that position, but I found the movie very compelling.
No, I think you're right. That's what Ted Bundy was known for. He was sadly charismatic. He was charming. And that's how he, you know, lured most of his victims, by being himself, by using his confidence and his ability to attract based on his looks and charm. That is the Ted Bundy that has been reported widely. So I never once thought, like you, yeah, that this was glamorizing Ted Bundy or making him out to be something he wasn't, or even exaggerating those moments either. So I thought it was, you know, for the most part, pretty well handled, and I thought this was pretty damn solid, and I'm glad, because this is one I was looking forward to. As I said, that's my offerings done for Tribeca as of yet. So I've got a bunch more we're going to talk about next week, but I'm going to throw the floor over now to JB for the final few.
And I'll just do three more and kind of quick. I'm going to spend a little more time with this one. This is The Justice of Bunny King. It's a directorial debut for Gaysorn Thavitt. I'm sure I've said that perfectly. But it stars a pretty big name at this point, Essie Davis, New Zealand actress. It is set in New Zealand. I'm 90% sure. I hope I'm not wrong on that. And then its co-star is Thomasin McKenzie. Those are definitely the two predominant faces that you'll see. I really was impressed with this movie. It is emotionally damaging. I'm trying to think if it really fits into the movie that it's making me think of, but did you ever see Falling Down with Michael Douglas?
No, I didn't.
So that's like everything's falling apart kind of movie, and like a man willing to risk it all. I don't remember much of that movie. I saw it when I was very young. I recently heard something where it was like, that movie's more messed up than I remember. I only remember the basic loose premise is that like I think he gets fired, then he just kind of like loses it and goes kind of postal, I think was the term at the time. Mm. And I saw it when it came out like on VHS when I was a kid. So it's been a long time, but that kind of is part of the story. It's like, this woman is trying to get her kids back who were taken. And we don't initially know why they were taken. From her, but she's trying to get her kids back, and she has to meet all these, you know, prerequisites in order to get her kids. And it's hard times. The housing market's really competitive. She is already, you know, up against it because she doesn't have a good job. And there's a lot of backstory that you gradually learn more and more about why she's in the position that she's in. But you also see how the world perceives her because of the position that she's in and how there's a lot of judgment placed on her and things of that nature. And so she's already up against everything. And her sister and her sister's, I think, husband or at least boyfriend, like live-in boyfriend, have their daughter, Tanya, Thomas and Mackenzie, and two other younger kids. And Bunny, who is Essie Davis, witnesses something that she just can't ignore, but it's going to make her life even harder. And so she makes these hard choices and basically puts it in a position where she sees what she wants getting farther and farther away from her, being able to get her kids back. Yeah. And so she makes some really bad choices, but out of desperation to try to get what she desires so much so, right? Because I think she feels like nothing will, there's no way she's going to be able to do it within the system. Mm-hmm. So she's going to do whatever she can to make things right, despite the system, right? Which, as a viewer, you know won't ultimately work, right? Because if you're doing things against the system, eventually the system will catch up to you.
Yep.
And then you won't get the thing you want. So, like, it's a you see a tragedy in the underlining of the plot. Without telling you what happens or how it plays out, it can't go well if it's any kind of grounded drama. Because it's just like, that's not, you don't get to keep going after you do these things, right? Like, it's just not going to happen. So, mm-hmm. But the performances and the characters are so outstanding. It's such a good debut. I was really, really blown away with this movie. It was, I wish I hadn't watched it first thing in the morning, because it definitely made me like kind of done for the day. I'm just like, it's a heavy movie. It's a heavy content. And if I'm not mistaken, there is a lot of, controversy with New Zealand and their, custody laws. I feel like, I have not seen Taika Waititi's film, The Boy, but I feel like that movie deals with that issue as well. Mm-hmm. And you see it a little bit in Hunt for the Wilder People, the other Taika Waititi film, where there's like the whole child system is not perfect. And I think this movie is a criticism of it. But also maybe like a criticism of society and how we condemn people for perception that isn't, we don't always know all the context. And maybe if you were to look at the context, it wouldn't be so black and white as to what the rules are and why a woman doesn't deserve to have her kids, where like another person maybe doesn't deserve to have their kids. Maybe this woman does, despite what's happened to her. You know, you don't always have all of the context. And I think this movie does a really good job of kind of bringing that up in interesting ways. And it's just, again, tough watch for sure. It's emotional. But man, it's definitely, if you want to see some acting lessons, Essie Davis is just outstanding in this movie.
Yeah. JB, he sent me a message when he'd watched this film with a kind of top level emotional feeling where he was at, and I thought, oh dear, because I know what it means when John describes a film as, you know, pretty heavy, pretty hard going. I know exactly what he meant. So I mean, I haven't seen this film. I'm looking forward to seeing it. The fact that Essie Davis is in it is enough for me. As we mentioned last week, every time I see her, whether it's obviously The Babadook is where most people know her from, but then she was so good in Baby Teeth. She was so good in The True History of the Kelly Gang as well. I mean, I think she's fabulous. And add Thomas in as well. It's a very good, you know, up-and-coming and established cast. The story itself is one which is, I assume, was prime for this kind of weightier film. And judging by what you said, yeah. I'm so looking forward to jumping in to see how this hits me as well. But, yeah, good show, my friend. And I'm glad it hit you the way it did, because I remember we spoke about this one last week as well.
Yeah, I mean, just when I saw the cast, I was sold on it, and then it lived up to my expectations for sure.
Good man.
So the next two I'm going to just kind of real quickly talk about, they're both documentaries, and Accepted is any teacher for sure should watch this documentary, but it's one of those, I would put it up there with like Wiener or Three Identical Strangers, where it's not exactly what you think it is when you get into it. And or Tickled is another really good documentary where it's got like plot twist, like unexpected changes in what the film ends up being about. So much so that I think even the filmmaker maybe didn't know what they were getting into when they were making the film. And those are always really compelling on the surface anyways. But Accepted, it follows specifically Mike Landry, who started a school called the T.M. Landry Prep School in Louisiana. And in, I think, 2017 or 2018, boasted 100% college acceptance for their seniors, with 30% of that going to Ivy League schools in a district that was notoriously not good in education. And he kind of bucked the system, changed things, and that's what gets the documentary's interest and why they're there. And then things become even more interesting without revealing anything. It's very, very well made. Dan Chen is the director. It's, yeah, definitely worth watching. And I would even say it's worth the money to rent. Although I would be surprised if this one doesn't get distribution, unless there's some kind of legal issues. There is a chance that people are going to try to shut some of the stuff down because of like what happens. And again, I won't say what, just check it out.
Okay. Interested.
And then Blind Ambition is kind of the feel good. It's hard not to draw a comparison to Cool Runnings, which is funny because in the movie itself, another person makes a fictional comparison to Cool Runnings. Like they're like, because what you have here is you're following the first ever Zimbabwe blind wine tasting competition, it's the World Wine Blind Tasting Championships. We're following four men, Joseph Tinashe, Marlvin, and Pardon, as they compete in this blind wine tasting competition. I didn't know this was a thing, dude, but it's pretty impressive. You taste the wine, and then you're guessing on where the wine is from, what year it is, what grape. Like, it's crazy, completely blind, and like you get points for each correct answer. And this is the first time there's a Zimbabwe team. So a lady in the movie says, it's like if Egypt suddenly had a skiing team, and I'm like, or if a Jamaican team
had a bobsled team.
Like, yeah. It's a movie, lady. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, that metaphor exists. Like, it's, or that allegory or analogy. Jeez, I'll get it out eventually.
You get that.
And so that cracked me up. But it's kind of got that vibe, man. It's like these four guys have amazing, crazy stories. They fled Zimbabwe to South Africa because Zimbabwe was having a horrendously hard economic crisis in like 2008, which led to horrible conditions for all of its citizens. So a lot of people left illegally and things like that. And some of their stories are very, you know, we decided to leave, no big deal. And others were crazy, like, you know, refugee story of like hiding in containers and moving illegally through systems to try to get to safety. Like, so right away they have compelling backstories, but then to find wine and how it's become their passion, because you can't just sip wine and like be good at this. Like, this takes a lot of effort, and it's super compelling in all regards. The guys have great personalities, which make them really, they're not characters because it's a documentary. These are real people, but yeah, they are really interesting people. So you're kind of hooked. And it's got, you know, there's always the underdog vibe to it, right? Cause it's their first ever Zimbabwe wine tasting team. Which is, just in and of itself, like you're rooting for them. You want to see how they do. So it's got all of those little elements in it, but it's real versus it being a fictionalized retelling of, or a, you know, actual just fictional story like Rocky. But it's there, and it's definitely a really compelling watch.
Right. Well, it's coming from somebody who just thinks a lot of wine tastes fairly similar. This could be quite an interesting watch. I don't know how people can do that. So,
yeah,
there we go.
I'm not a wine person. So yeah, but it's compelling to watch.
If somebody wants to give me a glass, I'll have it, but I couldn't tell you where it's from, how much it cost, or what undertones I'm getting in the back of my taste buds. I have no idea. It's just, does it taste like sour? Yes or no? That's how I kind of go by. But well, there's our first non-spoiler roundup of Tribeca, kind of the first 5 days or so of Tribeca. We're going to be back again next week with more of our thoughts and non-spoiler reviews and a kind of overall view of the festival as well. So hopefully we've given you some films there which you wouldn't mind checking out. If you do, let us know. It's tribecafilm.com. It would appear most of the films are available up until the 23rd, which is kind of coming to when the festival comes to an end as well. So, but do check it out. Do check out each film because it may vary individually. But let us know if you watch any of those based on our recommendations or if you'd heard of them, and whether you agree with us or whether you disagree. Either way, let us know. So we're so far you know, even with the ups or downs, we're having a bloody awesome time with Tribeca. However, that doesn't always, that's not always enough to maintain levels for us. We are the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. Individually, we're bloody awesome. However, you got to do a bit of work with that. So, John, how have you been staying bloody awesome this week?
Well, I have been playing more video games, specifically Ghost of Tsushima, which is a game I was interested in. I thought it might be too difficult for me to really get into, but it's turned out that it's right in my wheelhouse. It's got Assassin's Creed vibes. It's got Horizon Zero Dawn vibes, as far as like tons and tons of side quests and like little, like, you know, different skill points that you can earn to unlock stuff. I'm only a few hours into, I've probably played 10 hours at this point, but I have been doing so many side quests that I'm still like really, really early into the story because I just love the world. It's a beautiful game. Mm-hmm. It's the mechanics are really, really fun. There's so many different kind of approaches because you can be very stealthy, but that's not an honorable samurai practice. So you have to kind of, you're weighing that ethical battle of like, it's much more sensible in many situations to go stealthy, but it's not honorable. So that's a major element of the character, which I find super compelling. So I've been having a blast with it and committing some time. I'm trying to play at least a little bit every day.
Yep. I really want to play that game because I've seen screenshots of it and I've heard about the gameplay. It looks unreal. How stunning that game looks. I may add it to, it's on my list of games to rent. I may bump it up a little bit as well because it looks great. And if John has recommended it, you know me, guys, that's good enough for me. So John has been gaming and I have been busy working away to get a job. And finally this week found a job. I am now employed again after this wretched pandemic has caused obviously recruitment drives across the galaxy. So someone was foolish / kind enough to offer me a job, which don't start for a few more weeks, but I've been staying bloody awesome by becoming a normal person again. And for me, it's another step into the N-word normality that we're never going to get back to, but at least we can strive towards anyway. So I've been staying bloody awesome by putting in the work and finally finding a half-decent job to get my teeth into in the next few weeks. So, John, I'm about to be like you again.
That is good news, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. I thought so as well. And to celebrate, I am going to buy myself, I've said a 12-pack of donuts, but I'm also buying a gym membership. So one or the other, I think I know what's going to win, and it will be the gym. So I'm going to be like Burke. BLB is the motto for this show. But that is the episode. That's our first review of the Tribeca offerings for 2021. We are going to be back same time again next week with another round of Tribeca coverage and kind of roundup of the festival as well, or our thoughts and feelings on how it's been and how the virtual fest is and the offerings. So that being said, if you want to find us and tell us all about the films you've hopefully seen from Tribeca, you can go online on Twitter at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast. Instagram, John, where are we?
We are a bloody awesome movie pod.
And if you are a Facebook user and want to find us, just search for Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast and you'll see us. John, everyone's just heard you. They should follow you. Where can they follow you?
You can find me at BurkeReviews.com and at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms.
Go do that. You can find me whatiwatchtonight.co.uk and What I Watch Tonight across those same social media platforms. And you can find the both of us on Letterboxd as well. And if you like what you've just heard, please do consider sharing this with fellow film fans and dropping 5 stars on your podcast provider of choice, because it helps the show grow, gets more people listening, and it gets more engagement with film fans who, for the most part, are the best fans in the entire world. So if you do have a spare 5 minutes, we'd really appreciate that. However, all that being said, as always, stay bloody awesome.
And keep watching movies. Blood, 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 bloody. Blood, 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 bloody, blood, 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 bloody, blood, 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 bloody, blood, blood, bloody. Awesome. Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app.
Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Blah, 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 blah